Good morning, everyone, and thank you for participating in today's call, where NOAA will provide preliminary summaries of the December and the 2015 climate highlights, as well as announce the number of individual extreme weather and climate events that the U.S. experienced last year that reached the $1 billion threshold. Again, my name is Brady Phillips, Public Affairs Officer with NOAA's Office of Communications in Washington, D.C., and I'll be facilitating the call today. Today, we'll have two presentations followed by an operator-assisted question and answer session. During the call today, our speakers will be talking to a PowerPoint presentation that can be found online at www.ncdc.noaa.gov/SOTC/BREFINGS. And again, if that is on our media advisory on NOAA.gov, if you weren't unable to get the full URL. So today we do have three folks on the call today, all from NOAA's National Centers for Environmental Information in beautiful Asheville, North Carolina. And our first presenter is Jay Crouch, a climate scientist who will provide a summary of the U.S. 2015 and December climate reports. The second presenter is Adam Smith, an applied climatologist who will discuss the number of weather and climate disasters from 2015, again, that reached the $1 billion threshold. And we also have Deke Arndt, the chief of the climate monitoring branch at NCEI, who will assist with the Q&A session at the end. So let's begin with Jake Crouch from NCEI. Jake.
Good morning, everyone. Thanks for joining us on this call. I'm going to start off talking to slide number two on the slide deck you can download from our website. Just released this morning, the contiguous U.S. had its second warmest year on record. The graphic on the left shows how those temperature rankings broke down across the U.S. Each number on each state indicates a rank. So a value of 121 would indicate that state had its warmest year on record, and a value of 1 would indicate that state had its coldest year on record. Do you notice no state was record cold, and actually no state was actually cooler than average during 2015? Every state had an above average temperature for the year. We've noticed that a lot of the warmth during 2015 was situated across the West, parts of the Great Plains, and the Southeast. There were four states, Oregon, Washington, Montana, and Florida, that had their warmest year on record. To break down the year a little bit, the year started out record warm in the West. That persisted through much of 2015, but the West ended on a little bit of a cool note in 2015. The opposite was true in the East. If you remember, this past winter was exceptionally cold in the Northeast, with many locations starting out the year record cold. But we ended the year on a record warm note in the Northeast, and that helped boost the annual temperature in that location. Looking at the graphic on the right, that shows how temperatures have evolved throughout 2015 compared to the other top 10 warmest years in the U.S. The black line indicates the 2015 values, and as you move from left to right through the month, each month includes the data from every month previous. So we can see here that the December value for 2015 includes all of the values for every month of the year, and it shows that 2015 was the second warmest year on record, only bested by 2012, which was an exceptionally warm year here in the contiguous United States. Moving on to slide number three to break this down a little bit more, looking at average temperatures throughout the year. The larger map shows departures from the 20th century average on our climate division level. As you can see, every climate division in the contiguous U.S. was warmer than average in 2015. A lot of that warmth, as I mentioned earlier, was located in the West as well as the Southeast. The smaller maps on the bottom indicate the other top five warmest years for the U.S. to give a spatial breakdown of how 2015, the second warmest year on record, compares to the other top five warm years in the U.S. And you notice the first map on the bottom left is of 2012, the warmest year on record. The table on the right shows how the top 5 years compare for the contiguous United States, and the average temperature in the lower 48 was 2.4 degrees above average for 2015, and that's about 0.9 degrees cooler than the record warm year in 2012. Moving on to slide number four to talk about precipitation across the U.S. in 2015, the contiguous U.S. did experience its third wettest year on record. Only 1973 and 1983 were wetter than 2015. And an interesting note, 1973 1983 were both strong El Nino years. So all three of the wettest years on record for the contiguous U.S. have a strong El Nino presence. The graphic on the left shows the statewide precipitation breakdown. The darkest greens indicate states that were record wet, including Texas and Oklahoma. There are other states across the central U.S., the Midwest, and part of the Southeast and Mid-Atlantic that were much wetter than average. Once again, the values indicate the rank for that state. A value of 121 indicates the wettest year on record for that state. A value of 1 would indicate the driest year on record. We did have a couple of states that were drier than average, including California, but the state had its 13th driest year on record. The state has been dealing with exceptional drought during all of the year. The year started out very dry for the state, but over the past couple of weeks, extending back into December and parts of November, beneficial rain has fallen there, which helped boost the annual precipitation total for the state. The graphic on the right shows a time series of U.S. precipitation totals back to 1895, and we can see that 2015 there on the end ranking as the third wettest year on record. It's quite a wet year for much of the U.S., and that shows up in both the map on the left and the time series on the right. Still speaking to slide number 4, I did want to mention that our U.S. Climate Extremes Index, which is a way of measuring extremes across the U.S., both temperature and precipitation, was the fourth highest on record. That was really driven by warm temperatures, both daytime and nighttime, one-day precipitation totals, and days with precipitation. Moving on to slide number 5 to talk about December. December was the warmest and wettest December on record that the contiguous U.S. has experienced. This is the first time in our 121-year period of record that a month has been both the wettest and the warmest month on record. The temperature for the contiguous U.S. was 6 degrees above average, and the precipitation total for the U.S. was 1.58 inches above average. The graphic on the left shows those statewide temperature ranks for the month of December. There were 29 states across the eastern U.S. that were record warm. It was quite an exceptional month in terms of temperatures that we experienced here in the U.S. As I mentioned earlier, parts of the West did have near to below average temperatures to round out the year. Excuse me. The graphic on the right shows the precipitation breakdown across the U.S. Much of the contiguous U.S. did experience wetter than average conditions. Iowa and Wisconsin were both record wet, and states further to the south had their second wettest year on record, and that contributed to record flooding along the Mississippi and its tributaries, which locations in the lower Mississippi River are currently dealing with. We did see dramatic drought improvement in parts of the Pacific Northwest, where beneficial rain did fall during the month. Moving on to slide number 6 to break down on a climate division level what temperatures look like during the month, we see that exceptional warmth engulfing much of the eastern U.S., and so the map on the top right indicates the temperature departures from average for December, which was the warmest year on record. And then the bottom four maps compares the spatial pattern of temperature departures for the other four top five warmest Decembers. The table on the right shows how those temperatures broke down for the top five warmest Decembers for the contiguous U.S. And we see that December 2015 really blew away the competition in terms of departures from average. With that, I will hand it off to my colleague, Adam Smith.
Good morning. Today, I am providing an update on U.S. weather and climate events that caused damages of at least $1 billion each across the United States last year. First, I will discuss highlights from the U.S. disaster map on slide 7. In 2015, there were 10 weather and climate disaster events with losses exceeding $1 billion each. These events included a drought event, 2 flooding events, 5 severe storm events, a wildfire event, and a winter storm event. Overall, these events resulted in the death of 155 people and had significant economic effects on the areas impacted. Of particular note were the late December Texas tornadoes and Midwest flooding, the early October South Carolina flooding, and the U.S. wildfire season, which I will briefly discuss. First, in many people's minds, are the ongoing effects from the late December Texas tornadoes and Midwest flooding. Just one day after Christmas, a powerful storm system packing unseasonably strong tornadoes caused widespread destruction in the Dallas metropolitan region. damaging well over 1,000 homes and businesses. This same potent system also produced intense rainfall over several Midwestern states, triggering historic flooding that has approached or broken records at river gauges in several states. The flooding has overtopped levees and caused damage in numerous areas. This historic storm also produced high wind, snow, and ice impacts from New Mexico through the Midwest and into New England. Overall, the storm caused at least 50 deaths from the combined impact of tornadoes, flooding, and winter weather. Another historic event was the U.S. Western wildfire season, which burned over 10.1 million acres across the U.S. in 2015. This is a new record for the highest annual total of U.S. acreage burned by wildfire since record-keeping began in 1960. 2015 surpasses 2006, which has the next highest annual total of 9.8 million acres burned. The most costly wildfire occurred in California, where over 2,500 structures were destroyed due to the Valley and Butte wildfires. The most extensive wildfires occurred in Alaska, where over 5 million acres burned within the state. There was also extensive burnt acreage across other western states, most notably Oregon, Washington, Idaho, Montana, North Dakota, Colorado, Wyoming, and Texas. The third event I'll highlight is the historic rainfall and flooding that impacted South Carolina in early October. This flooding caused widespread damage to homes, businesses, public buildings, and infrastructure. This interrupted commerce and closed major transportation corridors for weeks as the river slowly receded. Locally extreme rainfall totals exceeding 20 inches were common, resulting in the convergence of a powerful low-pressure system and a frontal boundary, in addition to the copious moisture provided by Hurricane Joaquin in the Atlantic. Now we will discuss slide number 8. This slide shows how the different types of billion-dollar weather and climate disaster events have changed over time. Some highlights are that in 2015, the U.S. experienced 5 distinct disaster event types, including drought, flooding, severe storms, massive wildfires, and winter storms. It is more common to observe 3 or 4 of these major disaster event types in a given year, as opposed to 5 or more disaster types, which exceed $1 billion in the same year. This occurs less frequently, including the years 2015, 2011, 2008, 1998, 1994, and 1989. Also, looking back over the last 5 years, 2011, 2012, and 2015 were truly extreme years climatologically, as we saw several types of all-time records broken. During those years, in particular, the U.S. experienced more extreme weather events, which is compounded by the fact that lots of our built infrastructure exists in hazardous areas. And now I'll turn it over to Brady.
Thank you, Adam. Excuse me. I think we're now ready to take specific questions from the call participants. Operator, can you remind the callers how they can queue up a question? Operator?
Sorry about that. I was on mute. At this time, if you do have a question, please press star 1. We do currently have 4 questions in queue. Again, please press star 1 if you have a question at this time. Please stand by. Our first question will come from Seth Bornstein of the Associated Press. Your line is now open.
Yes, thank you. Actually, it's 2 questions, maybe for Jake or Deke if he wants to jump in here. First is looking at, in general, over the past several years since the last large El Nino 98, the U.S. seems to have always been sort of a laggard compared to the global figures. When you know the globe hits a record like last year, we were barely above normal. This year, we're not quite, it's number 2, not number 1, where the rest of the world is, you know, overall. Is there some reason why, in general, the U.S. often isn't, the contiguous U.S. often isn't record-setting when the world is, or is that just coincidence? And then the other one is it possible to generally tease out from this year as a whole, not just December, what, how much, who, which was the bigger influence, El Nino or anthropogenic warming, or, you know, give a sense of how much is in play in both of these? Thanks.
Hi, Seth. This is Deke. To address your first question, the U.S. being second warmest on record is a big part, as an example on a small scale, of the types of outcomes that, when put together, give us our warmest global, or will give us our warmest global temperature on record. It's certainly nothing to dismiss as not being unusual. So, you know, we second warmest on record, although it doesn't ring the bell, it is a very warm year across a large country, and you put that together with very warm years across other large parts of the globe, and they come together. So it is emblematic of what will ultimately be the warmest year on record for the globe looks like at a smaller scale, the one we experienced. As far as the outcomes with the U.S., you know, the 2012 was the warmest year on record. That was not an El Nino year, so we can have very warm years without El Ninos. I think Jake pointed out that the wet years tend to be associated with really strong El Ninos, at least those in the since the late 20th century. You know, there are a lot of factors that drive regional outcomes in the United States. We had the what was called the blob earlier in the year that was really influencing a lot of the weather in western United States especially. So I wouldn't pin all of this on El Nino or overall large-scale global warming or the blob. You know, climate is an outcome of many ingredients and many factors working together to give us the results that they do, and they all kind of came together to give us the year that we had.
Is there one that was more than the other, if you had to choose for the overall year?
I think a lot of the wetness that we saw late in the year in the east is symptomatic of what one would expect in an El Nino year. I don't think any given factor drove annual outcomes for sure.
Thank you.
Our next question will come from Peter King of CBS News. Your line is now open.
Great. Thank you very much. And I'm not sure if this question is for Deke or if it's for Jake. And, you know, to everybody on this line, we get what 2.4 degrees means. But to the average layman who hears 2.4 degrees and says, well, that doesn't sound like a lot, can you explain why this 2.4 degrees is considered fairly extreme?
Sure. I think one thing to think about is if we all went home and reset our thermostats 2.4 degrees higher in our homes for a year, we would certainly feel the difference over time. And a lot of natural systems and a lot of our built environment is tuned in many of the same ways that are used to outcomes in a certain range of temperatures. 2.4 degrees, although on a day-to-day basis, may not be that big a deal, over time it is large because it is, you know, part of the events that build that 2.4 degrees difference are like what we saw in much of the eastern United States in December. So it represents larger and more impactful events that occurred during the year.
And just as a clarification, number one, is that Deke answering the question?
I'm sorry, yes, this is Deke.
Okay, and number two, I mean, years and years ago, weren't these changes measured in like tenths and hundredths of a degrees rather than whole degrees?
Well, not necessarily so for the contiguous United States. It represents a small part of the world, and we can see variability, you know, bouncing around in, you know, whole degrees or large parts of degrees. So it is different than the global record, which your statement would be accurate for the global record.
Great. Thank you.
You bet.
Our next question will come from Doyle Rice of USA Today. Your line is now open.
Great. Thanks for doing this, as always. A couple questions. Has there ever been a year that was both in the top three, wet and warm? Or has this ever happened? I know you mentioned December was, you know, the first time that was both the wettest and warmest, but has there ever been a year that's been in the top two or let's say three of both categories?
Hi, this is Jake. Looking at just the most recent record, it looks like 1998 probably met that criteria of being both a really warm and really wet year. And coincidentally, that was also a very strong El Nino year.
Okay. It was probably in the top two or three for each?
Yes, I could get the exact number for you, but I think that 1998 was both a really warm year. I think it's currently fourth warmest in our period of record. It would have been third warmest before 2015. In terms of precipitation, I don't have the exact rank in front of me, but it was a very wet year for the contiguous U.S. as well.
Okay, and the second one would be, how unusual is this as far as the disasters go to have a wintertime flood of this such a scope in the Mississippi? Is this one of the, could it be considered one of the costliest Mississippi River wintertime floods?
This is Jake again. In terms of flooding on the Mississippi, it is unusual to see this type of flood event at this time of year. Flooding along the Mississippi typically occurs in the springtime. Spring is when we're dealing with snowmelt across much of the plains, which is feeding water into the river system. And we also have to consider that spring is also climatologically a pretty wet time in the Midwest. And so that also contributes to typical springtime flooding. So the fact that this record-breaking flooding is occurring at this time of year is unusual.
Okay, thank you.
Our next question will come from Scott Bixby of The Guardian. Your line is now open. Please check your mute button to pick up your handset.
Sorry about that. I was on mute. I was just wondering, I suppose this question would be for Jake, when did NOAA begin keeping records for average U.S. temperatures? When did these records begin?
In terms of our period of record for the contiguous U.S., we have data going back to January 1985. So that gives us 121 years of record. We started 1895, I think I misspoke. So 1895 is when our period of record begins for the contiguous U.S., giving us 121 years of data. We started doing this operationally here at NOAA's National Centers for Environmental Information in the late 90s. So we've been doing this for a while now, and our data set dates back to the late 1800s.
Thank you.
And our next question will come from Andrea Thompson of Climate Central. Your line is open.
Hi, yes. I just had two quick questions. So was December the first time any month has been both the warmest and wettest?
When we look at our entire period of record back to 1895, December currently is the only month that holds both the title for wettest and warmest month. Looking at if this has occurred in the past, back to 1930, this is also the first occurrence this has happened.
Okay. And then I don't know if you can say how many, because I know you guys have said before, like how many months in a row it is of above average temperatures. Can you say how many that is now?
This is Jake again. So looking at 2015, the only month of the year that we had below average temperature for the contiguous U.S. was February. So December would make the 10th consecutive month that we've had above average temperatures for the contiguous U.S.
Okay. Thanks.
Our next question will come from Brian Sullivan of Bloomberg News. Your line is open.
Thank you. This is for Jake, I guess. The Mississippi River flooding, how much of that happened as a result of the fact that it was so warm in the eastern U.S.? I mean, if it had been a normal December and it had been cold, would have a lot of that precipitation been locked up as snow and ice?
This is Jake. I think that the fact that it was so warm in the east did contribute to the flooding, and the fact that if it had been colder than it had been, a lot of that precipitation would have fallen as snow. And we would have seen that snow melt later in the season. So the fact that it was so warm, that also provided somewhat of a supercharged atmosphere. A warm atmosphere holds more water, so more precipitation will fall in an event that is warmer.
So it's a combination of it being warmer than average in terms of the precipitation falling as rain and not snow, and the fact that a warmer environment produces more rainfall.
Thanks.
Our next question will come from Craig Miller of KQED. Your line is open.
Thanks. Good morning, everybody. I'm looking at slide number 8, which I think was Adam's slide, but anybody who wants to take a stab at this. One thing, it's hard to draw to extract actual values from this visually, but it certainly does look like the severe storm component of this has been growing. But it also, I see you break out winter storms and tropical cyclones separately from that. So what do you consider a severe storm? How is that different from those? And are you willing to tie that, what appears to be a growth in that component, to warming? And then I have a quick follow-up on the wildfires component after that.
Hi, this is Deke. So the severe storm tends to be associated with what we might call violent local convective weather. These are storms that produce localized, very strong damage, so severe thunderstorm winds, large hail, tornadoes. As far as attributing the recent spate of, a large number of severe storm events ranking in the billions, you know, these types of rankings are a combination of both the physical weather events that happen, the structures that are built in the path of these weather events, and the value of those structures that are built in the path of these weather events. So it is a difficult job to ascertain which components of these are responsible for the growth. It is, again, an outcome that is a result of a complex combination of factors that go into it.
Okay, and on the wildfire component, I realize you're just measuring one parameter here, and that's number of events, but it looks like that has not particularly grown over time. And that seems to run contrary to some of the reports and studies that we've seen. Can you comment on that as well?
I'm sorry, Craig. I don't think we fully understood your question. Can you repeat that?
Yes, I'm in the communications business. Sorry. The wildfire component of that same graph, that just visually does not appear to have been growing very much over time. Just looking at numbers of events, I realize there's other parameters like acreage and things. But can you comment on that? Because we've seen, you know, various reports and, you know, they indicate that wildfires are growing.
Hi, yes, this is Adam. So what the chart is showing right now are the frequency of when the suppression costs and the damages from wildfires from the most selected damaged states exceeds $1 billion in a year. And as you'll note from the chart, particularly from the year 2000 forward, we have many more wildfire seasons that reach this threshold. Before 2000, it was not as common. There were more damage events, towns and cities burned in California in particular. And so, again, it's a combination of suppression costs and also physical insured loss due to wildfire.
Okay, so you would say that over time, the number of major wildfire events has increased?
I would say that, yes.
Okay, thanks.
Our next question will come from James West of Mother Jones. Your line is open.
Hi, guys. Thanks for doing this. I wanted to talk about the December figure in particular. On my slide, it's page 6, the departure from average for the 5 warmest Decembers. I think, Jake, you said previously that the wetness of December accorded with what you might typically expect in an El Nino year. I wanted to see whether you might comment on the heat aspect on that, and, you know, also for layman readers, why there's such a split between east and west. You know, you can just totally see that on the graph, and wondered about that.
This is Jake. Speaking to the extreme temperatures that we saw across the eastern half of the U.S. During December, the graphic on number page number six really shows that in great detail. There was a couple of factors that contributed to this east-west divide in terms of temperatures. We did have a strong phase of the Arctic Oscillation in the North Atlantic. That tends to create conditions that favor above average temperatures in the eastern U.S. So that was a contributing factor. During El Nino Decembers, we also tend to see warmer than average conditions in the eastern U.S. So there's two climate modes of variability that were acting in unison, creating one particular outcome across the eastern U.S., which was much warmer than average. Across the western U.S. during El Nino years, we tend to see a pretty active storminess pattern. We did see that in December. So when we do have an active storm pattern, that tends to keep temperatures suppressed. And so that is what we saw happening in the western U.S., kind of two different things occurring on both coasts that contributed to the record warm month, but it really was the record temperatures in the east that drove the contiguous U.S. average temperature during December.
Thank you very much.
Our next question will come from Brian Kahn of Climate Central. Your line is open.
Hi, yeah, I was curious to know if I could talk a little bit about the number of billion-dollar disasters in 2015. Two questions, actually. One is if you have any preliminary estimates about what some of those disasters might cost as far as specific dollar amounts. And then the second part of that is just I'm curious to know if any of those events can be attributed to certain overriding climate factors, whether it's El Nino, climate change, the Arctic Oscillation, or any other, things that folks might recognize as far as driving certain types of patterns.
Hi there, this is Deke. The cost estimates associated with these events will be released later in 2016. It does take some time to compile the information from multiple sources. And we don't invest much of our time in investigating the overall climate drivers of these events. We tend to look at them in the big picture and to help track what is going on in the United States. There are many research efforts around that are looking into this attribution science to determine what climate factors may have provided an overriding influence for particular outcomes.
Our next question will come from Grace Hood of Colorado Public Radio. Your line is now open.
Great. Hi, good morning. I'm not sure if anyone can address this because I know this data isn't totally focused on climate factors, but I was curious what Adam said about the shift in major wildfires. The number of events has increased over the last decade. Wondering if Adam or anyone on the call can address the role that climate change is playing in this shift. Thanks.
Hi, yes, this is Adam. Certainly, we're seeing more frequent, more intense wildfires in the West, particularly over the last 10 to 15 years. And many of these years are also drought years in the central or western states. We often find drought and intense wildfire seasons as a coupled phenomena.
Thanks.
Our next question will come from Tom Manry of the Toledo Blade. Once again, if you do have a question, please press star 1 and record your first and last name at the prompt. Your line is now open.
Yeah, it's Tom Henry at the Toledo Blade. Anyways, my question was the knowing effects are never evenly spread. There seems to be kind of a combination here of anomalies. Obviously it's been a unusual year, but yet even though California, for example, had the above average rain in December, it for the year, it remained below average in drought conditions. I was wondering if you could address some of these, regional anomalies, how weird they are, how unexpected, and also in the context globally. I read something yesterday, if it's true, that was actually warmer over the North Pole yesterday than West Texas and Southern California, and just what does all this mean in terms of how strange things have gotten.
Hi there, this is Deke. Thanks for your question. The ranks themselves kind of describe how unusual they may be. So these are out of 121 years on record. And so, you know, for the year, Florida, Washington, Oregon, and Montana, this is unprecedented, at least since 1895. And that kind of gives you an idea. Again, this is the average of the conditions, like you said, over the course of a year. The fact is we live in a warming world, and a warming world is bringing more big heat events and more big rain events to the United States. We see that in our record. We expect that more in our future. So 2015 is emblematic of what we have already seen and what we would expect in the future, and is that we're going to be dealing with more extreme heat events and more extreme rainfall events. And I think that really showed up in the December 2015 results, and it showed up in the results for the year as a whole.
Okay. As a quick follow-up to that, I also, where was it? I was curious, is there anything more to say about Alaska and Hawaii? You mentioned the Alaska wildfires. I know this is about the contiguous U.S., but just in terms of temperature and rainfall, how Alaska and Hawaii fared?
This is Jake. In Alaska, we do provide a statewide average temperature and precipitation value that accompanied this report that was released today. Alaska had its second warmest year, and their period of record dates back to 1925. The warmest year on record in Alaska was just last year in 2014, so we've had two really warm years in Alaska. Alaska was also wetter than average during 2015. We don't provide statewide values for Hawaii, but looking at a station-level basis, much of Hawaii was warmer than average during 2015. They also dealt with several intense rainfall events in Hawaii. The Central Pacific was very active in terms of tropical cyclones during 2015. That is related to the El Nino that developed during the year. And many of the months were record wet for many locations in Hawaii, and that is related to that above-average tropical cyclone activity in the Central Pacific.
And finally, just one last thing. Correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't 2015 globally expected to be the warmest? And if so, for the layman, could you explain, does it seem out of kilter or not that the U.S., the contiguous U.S. would be second warmest, whereas the rest of the world, you know, maybe the warmest?
Hi there, this is Deke. Our final annual analysis for the globe will be released on Wednesday, January 20th at 11 a.m. Eastern Time. We can't speak to the final outcomes for 2015, but it was very evident even and after some of our fall months that 2015 is very likely going to be the warmest year on record. And as far as the relationship with the global surface temperature versus the United States temperature, the U.S. takes up only 2% of the globe, and the globe is a mosaic of many tiles. And so there are at least 50 tiles the size of the U.S. that make up the global temperature. And with that, with the U.S. being second warmest, that is part of the mosaic that makes up what will ultimately likely be the warmest year on record for the globe.
Okay, thanks.
Our next question will come from Patricia Kitchen, of Newsday, New York. Your line is open.
Hi. Thanks, everyone. Yes, I wanted to ask a couple of things. First, about the February event, the cold and storm event in February. I realized that most of the expense would have been in Massachusetts, Boston, the huge snowstorm, but cold was also factored into it, and New York, Long Island specifically, I'm interested in, had, you know, the coldest February on record, the coldest month on record. And so I'm just wondering, so would have been included in your, you know, your calculations? Am I right? And also, what kinds of costs would be associated with that extreme cold weather? If you have any examples, what types of things like people out of work or, you know, highway maintenance things, or I'm not sure what, but I'll shut up and maybe you can start answering.
Hi. Yes, this is Adam. Yeah, certainly we take in many variables into account. Sure, and losses for snow, ice, wind, cold, which impact residential properties, businesses. There's also business interruption with that. Cars are damaged, traffic accidents, snow removal from cities and municipalities.
So
it is quite thoroughly covered.
Yeah, so that's included in the your overall calculations then, the, just the cold. Because Long Island didn't get hit really much by that storm. It got, you know, earlier one, but not so much snow that time, but it was definitely very, very cold. So, yeah. Thank you. And so also, on to December. And am I right, Deke, I think you were speaking about this, that the contributing factors to that incredibly warm December, it was El Nino. We often see warmer, you know, temperatures with, when there's a strong El Nino. And am I right that El Nino, what El Nino did was it impacted the jet stream, the path of the jet stream? So was that sort of what El Nino did? And also the Arctic Oscillation, was that the positive phase you said that it's in or that it was in?
Hi, this is Jake. In terms of the December outcomes and temperatures across the eastern U.S., especially for you in the Northeast, the El Nino tends to favor warmer than average conditions during December. That doesn't mean that every El Nino is going to be warmer than average in the Northeast in December, but we tend to see that, and that's what we did see in 2015. We tend to see a southerly flow across the eastern U.S. during early winter during El Nino events. And in terms of the Arctic Oscillation, the Arctic Oscillation was positive and very positive for parts of December. When we have a positive phase of the Arctic Oscillation, that tends to keep the jet stream further north and keeps cold Arctic air out of the contiguous United States. So the fact that we had a warm southerly flow across the eastern U.S. and that the fact that we had the jet stream much further north than the U.S.-Canadian border really helped to contribute to the record warm temperatures across the eastern U.S. in December.
Right. So it was the Arctic Oscillation that kept the jet stream further to the north then.
Yeah, the Arctic Oscillation is just a measure of pressure in the northeast, North Atlantic. And when that is in a positive phase, the jet stream is usually further north than what is climatologically expected.
I get you. So it's not really that it did that. It's just that it was, and that's what it means.
Right, yeah. So the Arctic Oscillation is just a measurement describing the phenomenon.
Right, okay, great. And this is Jake, right?
Yes, it is.
Oh, okay. Thank you very much.
Our next question will come from Bryce Anderson of DTN AG News. Your line is open.
Hello, and thank you very much for the briefing. One of the features that we saw in the southern plains during this past spring was how much rain and how quickly that rain eased the drought conditions. Can you comment on what you see regarding drought right now across the country? Is this going to continue showing improvement in the western part of the country, for example?
Hi there. This is Deke, speaking as a native Oklahoman. Many of the southern plains droughts do tend to end in very large rainfall seasons and rainfall years, 1957 being a pretty classic historical example. As far as drought in the United States, it has retreated mainly to the west, but it is fairly entrenched in the west. It takes a long time to get into droughts of this magnitude, and it can take a long time to get out of droughts of that magnitude. The west is a different animal than the plains. So while we are seeing some very welcome wet conditions in the western United States, we are not seeing a complete removal of drought like we did so rapidly across the plains and Midwest.
Okay, thank you.
You bet.
And our final question will come from Joel Scatta of the Natural Resources Defense Council. Your line is now open.
Hi. Thank you for this call today. I really appreciate it. I'm looking on slide number 4 with the chart that shows the contiguous U.S. precipitation increasing. It looks like there's like a trend of it increasing since about 1980, of it continually to get higher and higher. And I was wondering, are these just prolonged events, or are these just more extreme, flashier events? And is that a trend that's likely to continue?
Hi. So at this scale, this data really don't discriminate versus on single-day events versus prolonged events. We do see, in general, across the United States, using other measures such as the Climate Extreme Index, that both prolonged periods of rain, the big rain is getting bigger in the sense of individual events are getting bigger, the number of individual big rain events are getting bigger, and the duration of individual big rain events are getting bigger. So in those three facets, using a different metric, it does support the notion that, particularly in the wetter parts of the U.S., typically east of the Rockies, that big rain is getting bigger. I don't know how that shows up in this contiguous U.S. average, but when you break it down to a more local level like that, we do see big rain getting bigger.
Okay, thank you.
Great, thank you very much. That was our last question, and I will end up by giving a reminder of an upcoming event, just to mark your calendars. On January 20th, again at 11 a.m., NOAA and NASA will convene a joint media conference call to discuss each agency's respective average global surface temperature for 2015, and NOAA will provide a similar summary as we did for the U.S., except for the globe, in terms of climate highlights of the year. A separate media advisory will be distributed around the week of January 15th for that event, so look for it.